Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermes, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCB
106.5
FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
All right, you have fallen back into the House of Mystery, tripped by accident, because you wouldn't be here if you knew what you're thinking. And, well, there's Dave across the way. Hey, Dave. You're Dave today.
I'm Dave.
You're Dave today.
Hey, y'all.
I should call you Diesel.
Yeah, that's my cat's name.
Diesel Martini.
Wow. Yeah, Diesel Martini. There we go. There's another name. I like it.
You could use that. Like the one we had on yesterday about the two names that she had, you know?
Yeah.
Diesel Martini should have been her second name.
That should have been the second name.
Right? That would fit. Right?
That's perfect.
I'm going to email her and say, hey, listen, instead of this Amanda name, that's just too soft. Get no. Diesel. Come on.
Diesel.
Butch, you know, come on. Put us about. Well, we continue our progress this week, and we are speaking to another writer. And today we're going to focus on one of her books, and the book is In the Crypt with the Candlestick. And the guest is the author, Daisy Waugh. Thank you for being here, Daisy.
Thank you for having me here.
Well,
thank you, Alan.
See if you say that later.
Yeah, I'm Daisy Waugh again. I'm not sure what I will.
You're going to Waugh. Who is this Waugh? Well, it's really interesting. Now, you... looking through your history and kind of like your books even before this, it seems like you have a theme of, like, okay, this is part of a three comedic novel set. So maybe let's start there. What is a comedic or comic novel?
What is it? Well, I think the main aim is to make you laugh. But I think being made to laugh is sometimes... no, I don't want to get pompous about it. It's a novel to make you laugh. Yeah.
Okay, but is it like what kind of? So is it a serious subject that sort of has humor to it?
Well, I will get a bit pretentious. I mean, I've got a slight theory that comedians are often more serious than anyone actually, and I think that comedy comes from. I think people who don't do comedy. Get that it comes from often quite a sort of serious and sad place. So, and I think that's the case with most things, certainly, that make me laugh, that it's often, it's a sort of, uncomfortable and sorry state of affairs.
it touches on something that's real.
Yeah, and something that's uncomfortable and something that might be, you know, I mean, you know, it's like with Shakespeare's Fools or something, something that it's easier to say it when you make a joke than to say it seriously. There's stuff that you can't say with a dead straight face that you can say when you're coming at it sideways and making people laugh. I think there's definitely an under that. But actually, I mean, it's quite funny. I mean, I've written comedy and I've written humorous journalism for years, and that's the thing that I do. But it is funny because you do, I find that people get more, I think things like Twitter are so humorless. I think people have sort of slightly lost the ability to understand when people are joking a little bit. And I hope that won't last. I don't suppose it will because these things never do. But I do think that we're sort of rushing through a slightly humorless period in history at the moment.
And I think, you know, and well, the listeners to this show definitely know that's how I do things. I'm always sideways and I'm always making people laugh, hopefully. You know, but yeah, it's true. I agree with you totally. People are getting way too uptight about things and not even giving it a chance or not even trying to understand where others come from. So I think that's kind of, does that sort of make you careful on how you word things in your books?
It actually makes me incredibly depressed, to be honest. Beyond that, it used to make me very angry, I'm just starting. I should be a little bit further along with it, but I'm just starting number three at the moment of this in this trilogy of murder stories, comedy murder stories, and I've had a few. I've got a lovely in England where, you know, obviously the main show goes on. I've got a lovely editor, but she's you know, she's a bit younger than me, and she's quite of another generation, but she's lovely and clever and funny. But I've had a few battles with her, and sometimes it's just she's kind of fighting the corner of don't be bad taste, and in the end, you know, it's one small author against a kind of massive machine, so they generally win. But when I'm actually sitting in front of my computer, I make myself laugh, so I write it because I think it's funny. That's what comes out is the stuff that I think is funny. So the long answer, I could have just given it. No is the answer. No, I'm not very careful. But I think occasionally, as a consequence of that, I sort of hit up against kind of modern sensibilities and have to have a big battle about it and usually lose.
Oh, yeah, you always do with the publisher. I know. I just went through that. I'm still going through it right now with the two-book series. And I agree, you know, when they come back at you with words, I know. Sometimes it's surprising because, like, I'm on my 60th year, and I think that I'll just sort of say something or write something, and they go, "Oh no, you can't use that word." I can't.
Why?
We're going to have people upset. I think ghetto was the last one that I was told, and I was like, "Why?" They were in a ghetto. No, you have to say.
It does feel kind of random, like rally stuff. You know, you can't use that.
Yeah, I was like, oh, I'd never heard that before. Yeah, well, it should be a working class or something like that neighborhood, not ghetto. Oh, okay. But yeah, you're right. You can't really fight that when you're dealing with a company that's they're set out to make money and not to cause waves, right? So that's
right. Yeah. All that sort of stuff. Even though I'm in my 54th year, in fact, I'm 54, so that means I'm in my 55th year, all that sort of stuff still comes as a sort of shock to me, but I suppose it's the luxury of being not a team player. But each time it does come as a shock that there aren't, that, you know, that we're all in this, we're all creators at various stages in the process in publishing and stuff. It comes as a massive sadness, actually. But then again, I know that you know, the risks are different for all of us. But I'm amazed by how little people are willing to fight. That's what I suppose. But I do understand that I'm a solitary author. It's not my only source of income, and so I can afford to take risks or not care as much. But it is a bit depressing how little people seem to care about art. Anyway, shut up, Daisy. Let's be more jolly about all this, because my lovely books come out, and it's still quite funny.
Well, I'm wondering with, comic timing in fiction, do you have certain techniques for that, or is that just something that it comes to you more by ear?
It comes with editing and editing and editing, doesn't it? I mean, it's amazing. You write something and it's just not funny. You can take two words out and it comes and it works. All I know is when it's funny, but I don't quite know. I don't know what the rule is, but I do know that you can hear when one word will change everything and it will go from a really sort of deadbeat gag to something that's genuinely funny. So, well, in my opinion, anyway, what that makes me laugh. Yeah. So,
totally. I mean, I like that type. What made you decide to write this type of book? Like, how did that come about?
I think that people write what comes naturally to them in the end, don't they? I think that was the voice. You know, you have the voice that you have. So, people think they can write, they could write a bonk buster Jackie Collins or whoever the equivalent is, but they're writing something more high-fitting. I think you write with the voice that you write with, and that's inescapable. So I wrote comedy because I wrote comedy. Actually, before that, I've written a lot of comedy over the years in fiction and in journalism. But there was a period I wrote three novels of historical fiction set in 1920s America, in Los Angeles, actually. And what was I going to say about that? I've forgotten. They weren't very funny.
Los Angeles. Los Angeles, come on.
They were fabulous. It was Valentino and stuff like that, but they weren't very funny. Oh, I know what I was going to say. Was that? And then I wrote another one about the Triangle Factory fire in New York, another one about the National Guard in Colorado setting fire to some striking miners in 1913 or something. And actually that becomes rather depressing and lonely after a while. There's not only you're in history, there's also quite depressing stuff and blah, 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 blah. So when I went back to writing comedy, it was very much, and contemporary comedy, it was very much just because writing's lonely enough as it is. But if you can write contemporary stuff and it's making you laugh, it's a hell of a lot less lonely than writing about striking miners being set on fire in
1913. Well, yeah, so you're... You're having a better time sitting at your table laughing by yourself than being depressed. This is the second book, and you're going to have a third on in this series. When you when you have a series like this, do you plan everything? Do you know what's going to happen from beginning to the end of the third book when you're doing it?
Or is it just now, paper all over the room. I'm sitting with scribbled bits of papers of planning what you're supposed to know by page 20. With murders particularly, because the murder is just a hook, whereas before it might have been a romantic comedy, now I just let you know murder is the reason for people to keep on turning the page and to make some jokes and create some crazy characters. But you have to know who's doing it, you have to know why, all the way through you have to know that somebody has to think that person might be doing it or that. So there has to be endless decoys. So actually that part of it is like doing a crossword. Incredibly planned. And then you lose the joy if you plan the humor and the characters as well. So it's a funny balance of you have to know who done it and why, and who people think might have done it and why all the way through. So
You got to know how it's going to end, I guess, so to speak.
Yeah, and also what people are thinking all the way through. You have to lead them, in a non bossy way. You have to trick them on every page,
right,
I think.
Right, because people are so dumb and stupid that they...
No, that's a good storytelling. I'm reading a murder story.
they know I love them, so that's, listeners, I'm not even going to go there today, but but I find this interesting. So now when I talk to a lot who fiction writers, I'm always asking them what their relationship is with their characters, and that sounds like a weird question coming from a non-fiction person, because how do you have a relationship with fiction? And what is your relationship? Because I hear stories like, oh, it's like my family, it's like my friends, like they have this real thing going on. What is it for you?
Oh, absolutely! I really love them, and the more flawed they are, unless they're smug and priggish, and then I hate them. Otherwise, I love them all, and the more flawed they are, the better I love them. And I'm always quite shocked. I'm always rather disappointed when people say, gosh, I hated such and such a character, because almost, apart from, occasionally I have kind of punch bag hate figures who are just kind of goody-goody smug people who I just hate, and I just kind of pile all, but that's mucking around. But everyone else, and I love my murderer usually, and I love them. They are my, it is quite lonely being a writer, and I think you do spend a lot of time alone with your characters, and then my characters make me laugh, or I think they're quite brave, or I think they say things that I wish I would say, or so, yeah, they're my, yeah. Yeah, and even some from years ago. I remember I wrote a screenplay when I was very young, years ago I wrote it, and there's a one character in that, and I still kind of miss him. He still makes me laugh. And some of them you forget over the years.
Yeah.
But, and certainly the ones that in the book that you're actually writing, they are definitely pals.
Well, when you write your characters, can you actually hear them in your head? I know I hear voices when I write, but are you just more translating images and symbols and stuff like that into prose? How does that work for you?
No. I can hear them and see them, and I know exactly what they're doing and how they're saying it and what they're thinking. And they're very, very much alive in my head. Absolutely, I can see what shoes they're wearing and how they sit and. Yeah, no, it's lovely. I mean, it's so when I say writing's only, it's not actually, it's slightly, I suppose, slightly mad, isn't it? But it's
crazy like me.
Yeah. Are you on medication or?
Well, I mean, there are some no-go areas here, actually.
Yeah, yeah. It's just like I just get, you know. Yeah. Well, and so. Where do you draw your characters from? So, like, they're obviously very important, and they're a main part of the book. So where do these characters come from for you?
It's quite odd, isn't it? I think because they come from the slightest encounters, and then you and quite often I don't realise until quite late on. There's a woman I'm creating, or not creating actually, at the moment, she's going to play quite a big part in this number three. And I spent half an hour with her a year and a half ago, but somehow I didn't really notice it. But actually, she obviously sort of planted a seed of a type, of a way of approaching life, of a way of responding to things. And actually, I have to say, I'm going to find it quite hard to like her, but I bet you if we speak this time next year, I will like her. At the moment, I think she's monstrous. But anyway, so that's the answer. Yeah, just from the weirdest, slightest encounters, and then suddenly they've become massive, great characters in a whole book. And then people who you spend ages with, you think, oh, they'd be interesting, maybe I could use them. Actually, I don't seem to.
Maybe there's too much there. Already.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So there's not enough invent. Yeah, it's probably
right. Well, do you take people that are awful to you, mean to you, or rude, and kill them off in your book? Or
I think I have done. Did I do it in the last one? No. I mean, I do take kind of petty revenge on things, or things that irritate me, or turns of phrase that annoy me, or stuff like that. Who am I killing off in this one? Actually, I rather like one of the people who's dying, and I'm trying to think who's the other one. The other one I haven't yet. I might quite like her. Oh, wait, she's quite cool. So I can't what the original question is. So I've gone off thinking about Elisabetta and somebody or other. But
that's all right. We're getting it. It's just the idea of kind of your relationship with your characters and how. You know, and who you would kill off, and if it affects you, if it's someone that's really, if it's someone you really like in your book, some a character. It's
I wouldn't favorite, kill them off. I wouldn't.
You
kill
just
them
can't.
Off.
You can't kill them, right? Yeah.
In one of the American trilogies, I killed off a. There was something that was so painful in there. I wrote, and I. Well done, me. I'm sort of glad I did it, but I don't think I want. But that was a serious book, and that was more sort of supposed to make people cry. No, in these books, I don't kill off anyone I actually want to hang out with, because that would be stupid, you know? Especially since it's serious.
Well, has a character ever done anything to surprise you? Have they ever kind of gone off the rails and refused to do, you know, what you wanted them to do to progress the plot?
I've read that. I've heard that's happened to other people, but I generally have, before I start writing, a pretty clear idea of who I'm dealing with. So, no is the answer to that. No, I have a good idea of who they are, and I keep them on track.
You're the boss.
Yeah. I'm the boss, yeah. I'm the universe, I'm the boss, yeah.
So now, in this particular book, now when we're talking about the crypt and with the candlestick, can it stand on its own, or do you need to read the first one in the series?
Oh, no, that is the first one. You've got the first one. The second one's come out in London, come out in the UK, and the third one, it's got scribbled notes all over the floor of the room I'm sitting in at the moment. That is the first one. And yeah, they all stand alone. It's like with any of those books, you know, they're more fun when you've got, I mean, this one is particularly, they're all being introduced, all the characters, because it's new. But the point of it is there's characters that you like and you think, oh, yippee, let's go and hang out with those guys again. Not to the writer, but the reader. So they should all be able to stand alone, but they're more fun if you've started from the beginning.
Yeah, you know more history then of what's going on with people and how they interact with each other. So is there a subtext to the story? Do you have kind of some sort of intention or some sort of subject that you want to kind of get across to people, convey to someone that reads it, besides the story itself?
I think that it, you know, I suppose so. One of the things that I find most depressing, most alienating, most irritating. So, I mean, I think everything I write always, and obviously I got older and wiser as the years go by, but it's the same things that drive me mad, and that is pretension.
Oh, my.
Hypocrisy, cowardice. So those things, you know, all the jokes are, you know, pomposity. Everything I write is kind of deep, sort of, dealing with that in one way or another, laughing or trying to reduce it or trying to, that's the answer to that question. Yeah. So I do, it's pretension and hypocrisy and I think I've mentioned it already, you know, people being smug and complacent and thinking that they are good people, that I cannot bear it. So that is the general. And so in a way, that's quite fun writing murder stories because you can actually.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Now, do you like to set your story in a particular time period?
Well, these ones are contemporary, but they're set in a very, very grand, incredibly grand house in Yorkshire, like the size of a small town, like 18th century house. And that's contemporary. And the previous three I actually wrote under another name, but they were also comic murder stories about a tarot reading detective, and they were also contemporary. And so that's the last, what's the last five books I've written have been contemporary. And it's good fun, because you can, you know, if you, I love writing dialogue, and you can sort of hear the way people speak, and so at any rate, right now I'm very happy writing contemporary stuff. But, yeah. You know, who knows? Maybe I'll
but you're staying away from kind of modern day turmoil, so to speak. Like, you're not including anything that's going on, like with, you know, COVID or any of that stuff, or Donald Trump. There's no Boris Johnson flying around with hair.
There is not, actually. But there is, what should I have in the last one? I mean, it's quite hard, actually, because, you know, these, especially with publishing, things come out so much later, and things, especially in the last year and a half, have changed so madly and fast. I think in this one, I am going to make some jokes about the way different people have responded to the last year and a half. But I don't, you know, it's not, I have got very sore pieces, but it's not really the point. It's not a drum beating thing. It's just a piss take. I just want to piss take. So I didn't start swearing.
No, that's all right. We get it. But yeah, it's fine to make comedy of that in a way. I think it's helpful. I think it rather than, you know, the drum beating, so to speak, you know, putting someone down, exactly. It's almost better in a way to do it with a laugh, because, then people aren't feeling so, I don't know, separated or attacked, you know, then there's, you know.
Exactly, or defensive, and I think everyone's being pretty absurd, so it's not like it has to be a...
Yeah.
Particularly partisan, it's just
It's hard. I mean, Dave goes to all these anti-mask rallies with his cat, and you know, no one
refuses to wear a mask.
Yeah, and it's just like,
Dave, I love you even more than my cat, Dave.
You know, I just can't win here.
All right, well, I'll say that's what I'm doing here in London, so.
Your cat is rallying around.
Yes.
Some premium food here. None of this stuff. Kids bring some bit stuff. We want some real fresh food here.
That's right.
Boy, I'll tell you. Well, it's really interesting. So now, what is the basic story now that they're going to get in your new book, or in your old book, or our new book?
Any of them. So the one you've got there, let me think, what the hell is that?
Oh, I know, I hate that when that happens. You know, you do an interview on something that's...
The one before that was a film set. So the one before, that one is actually, because there are four children, and there's a sort of, there's this very, very grand house with this vast estate, and it's sort of an anachronism, because it's all incredibly grand, blah, 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 but obviously there's the modern world outside the gates, etc. And there are these middle-aged, slightly hopeless aristocratic children who can't really cope with anything. I mean, they haven't really had jobs. They're all completely hopeless. And there's a sort of mother who's desperate to escape running this boring estate, having to be polite to people all the day. And so she's trying to palm it off to one of her children. Anyway, then they all start murdering each other, and it's quite funny.
Oh, I didn't know this. So this is about the royal family.
English aristocracy. Yeah. God bless them all.
That sounds familiar. I think I know this story. I'm being mean. I know stuff like that. So who is your main character in it? And how would you describe your main character?
So there are two main. The two kind of. Actually, it's an ensemble. There are lots of people coming in and out. There are two young people who inherit the house by default because the four children are incapable. And then there is the oldest son who should have inherited the house. He's called Sir Egbert Toad. And he is kind of completely hopeless. He's kind of 50, never had a job. But he's he's very frank. He's never had to tailor anything about the way he behaves. So he's kind of childlike. But he's got this sort of... Anyway, they call him Mad Egbert because he's so frank, and he's and he hooks up with a woman who goes to work there, whose grandmother had worked at the house as a housemaid straight up just after the war, and she's there. So and they sort of kind of muck around, not really being quite lazy and being quite stoned and not really bothering to solve the murders with the capital around them. But the point of it is, it's quite, because England is actually much less than it was, you know, class riddled, that's got other problems now. But the point of it really is, you know, it's not the point, but one aspect of it is that they come from very different backgrounds. They used to know each other when they were tiny children because she used to go and stay with her grandmother, who was the housemaid. And there's this element of, both of them have this lovely, robust, utter lack of interest in class, as we all sort of imagine the English class system is. And so I guess that should be quite nice that they just don't get it. They're just totally without that particular pretension.
And yeah, they've never known real life. And well, and I love that name, Egbert.
Egbert. His first cousin's called Egbert, and he's disinherited because he didn't use the traditional, generationally conventional C in his name.
That is one thing very unique that North America doesn't have, is that kind of a royalty class, like the idea of names and behaviors in that sense. It's kind of different.
There's a lot of snobbery on the East Coast, isn't there?
But it's in a different way. You know, yeah. It's not like it's totally based on money in a sense, where it's not so much of a title or a name. And there's behaviors that you have in England and manners that are different.
I think it's changing a bit. I mean, I think money speaks much louder now than it did, and the aristocracy has lost its glamour. I think so. I may be wrong. In England, I think so. Things like all the sort of the in England the words that you use or you don't use which reveal which class you belong to. I don't know. My son went to Eton, which you probably heard of. It's this famous school. People either hate it, blah, 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 blah. And you might also know that in England, there's this thing where you mustn't say toilet. If you say toilet, it's like very, very unsmart. Well, my son went to Eton, and he and all his friends all say toilet. So I don't know what to say about that, except it's quite weird. I think it's just like a nothing thing. It's so unimportant compared to... Yeah.
The different classes are getting closer together.
Social
media. How do you like social media nowadays? And are you totally involved with your readers and things like that?
No, I sort of hate it, actually. In fact, I finally deleted all my Facebook stuff. And
wow, like you just put your foot down and walked away.
They do this thing, they leave it there, they say you come back and you can still keep it for another 23 days. And you know, if you're sort of old and slightly stupid, you think, oh my god, if I go anywhere near the computer, they're going to reignite the whole thing, it's all going to come back down. I think it now is genuinely redundant and doesn't exist anymore, so that's quite good. If that's true. I deleted WhatsApp, and then I spent quite a lot of time in Italy, and everybody communicates with each other on WhatsApp, so I had to then which is quite annoying. I can't remember that. And then this awful Twitter. It's just awful. It's just so depressing. Do you guys follow Twitter?
No, I'm on everything, but I very seldom have any interaction on there. It's all done for the show, for the books and stuff.
Right,
I think Facebook, I'm sort of, even that is pretty much just about down to the show and stuff. And I end up using Messenger a lot to contact other people, like the message service, but not really, I don't find much interest in it anymore. So
it's been a dark couple of years. I've joined onto something called Signal and something called Telegram, because I got completely paranoid by the power of, very aware of the great spread of the small tech companies.
You got the Bilderbergs over there. You gotta look out.
Right.
I heard about all that, and your queen's a lizard, last I heard. So
She's okay.
I hear all this gossip. We had a conspiracy theorist on that, like about that just a while ago. So you hear all these things. Wow. You have to wonder why it goes so far sometimes, you know.
I know. Well, I know. We all get into our tunnels, don't we, I'm afraid. Yeah. I think. Yeah.
Well.
Yeah. I had an attack with a teacher. I used to go and see her, and she'd tell me new things about the Queen selling Buckingham Palace, running a brothel in the basement, all that. Okay.
Well, you know, I find it curious.
It does.
I find that very curious because we laugh about all this stuff going on, but this is kind of this conspiratorial thing that goes on with people. It's gone on for generations. This isn't a brand new thing. We just see it a lot more with the social media. But I wonder, so do you ever think about adding characters that have that kind of conspiratorial thing in your books?
I'm thinking about it right now, actually, yeah. But I do, but I also think, because I've got so many drums to beat, and I don't want to beat them because it's boring, and anyway, my editor will tell me off if I do. But I think, I think with the conspiracy thing, I do think that, you know, anything that nobody can be bothered to think about is automatically dismissed as conspiracy. And so I don't, and there's lots of things I can't be bothered to think about, but I don't want to, it's a kind of a cheap joke, and I think in the mix of all that, there is can we all pause and think about what the hell is going on here? So I have some sense that maybe we don't entirely understand it, or it's not all being presented entirely as it is. So I don't know. I've got a good joke cooking with one character who's going to go around with a lot of aerosol sprays to keep people from standing too close to each other.
Well, there you go. That's what I mean. You gotta, you know. But I know. But people will take it also as you're taking a stand, in a sense, I think.
And it is boring.
Yeah.
It's not what people want.
Yeah, it's kind of all going on right now, and you don't. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, so someone picks up the book. They've never heard of you before. And they go out and pick up this book. What do you hope they take away from it?
Well, what I hope is they just think, in America, it's fine. In England, it describes a world that only a small number of people in England know about anyway, because it's the upper classes. So, but I hope, I mean, the point of it is, and it's like the same reason you find a novelist that makes you laugh and you think, I can't bear this world, I can't bear anything, I just want to plug out and I want to laugh. So that's what I want, is people who just want to laugh, and it's not a facile laugh, but who just want to laugh because actually it makes things more bearable. So that really is, you know, just go and have a bath and have a laugh, and I'll try and say anything else English vowel sounds in that sentence. Have a bath and have a laugh.
Well, I mean, so at the end of the day, the comedy is kind of the key element in the book.
Yeah, and it's supposed to just make, it's supposed to cheer people up, make people. Okay, so I don't know if you've ever seen there's a sitcom. There's a guy called Graham Linehan, he's Irish, actually. Oh, yeah. And there's some sitcom, have you heard of him? He wrote The Father Ted, and he wrote something called The IT Crowd.
Okay.
Anyway, he's a guy, and he's very funny. And before I'd heard about it, I found his comedy on the TV. And I was feeling incredibly depressed. I can't remember why life had gone wrong. And it just made me feel, you know, there are people out there who can see it's all absurd and who think it's funny, and I'm not alone. And that, I know I'm sounding incredibly earnest, but I think it is, that's what I want, is because I know that I find it incredibly comforting when I find there are people out there who can make it funny. And it's not just gags, but it's just, you know, this appalling world that we're in, it is funny as well. And that, and I suppose to that, at my most ends, that's what, is comfort, actually. Yeah. Comfort for people with a sense of humour.
Oh, yeah, no, so what influences you? Like, is it other writers, or is it comedy in itself? Like, is there something that gives you the energy to do it?
I mean, really teetering on the brink of getting more pretentious, so I mustn't. I think that when I find novels and sitcoms that make me laugh, that reminds me of what a valuable and useful thing it is that I do if I succeed. And I think it's if you are prone to feeling quite gloomy about the way things are, I find it very comforting with drawing and creating a world that makes me laugh. So those are the sort of answers.
So with that, but did you find it difficult to write during COVID and all that stuff?
I did. I found it impossible. Absolutely impossible. In fact, I didn't write. I wrote almost nothing. Almost nothing. I wrote something that was no good at all because it was so depressed and hopeless, and I stopped.
Did someone read that? They slit their wrists after they read it.
Well, I was wanting to slit my wrist reading it.
Well, that's not good. No, but
that's the good.
Don't really react well, I guess, in the writing sense when there's a lot of stress going on around or problems like that.
Or restrictions. I think it's restrictions. I think, you know, I've got three children, and well, they're now a little bit bigger, but I've always for years gone away somewhere to write, just to sort of, and obviously I couldn't do that, I'm gabbling so much drivel, I can't actually remember what the question was, but the general gist of it is, I agree with myself.
Well, you know, so what's next? After you finish the Crypt series, what are you going to go on to? You said like historical fiction or something?
No, I think, well, I'll see if this one has legs, or if I might get bored of it after three, but I don't think so. I'm quite pleased to be back with it now after the, and otherwise I have a sort of non-fiction idea that I might do. I never seem to run out of ideas when I need them. But I think at the moment I'm going to try and knuckle down and write this Toad Hall murder story, and then see what pings up in my brain after that. I mean, but then again, you know, publishing's changed so much. Mm-hmm. See if I can, if the rules are so strict and I can't make any jokes anymore, I might just, you know.
Become a dancer.
I'm wondering when you're done writing for the day, or in between writing books, do you have a way to relax and recharge and rejuvenate?
Yeah, I did do a lot of sport. I played a lot of tennis, a lot of yoga. I just qualified as a yoga teacher. Wow. That was my response to the COVID lockdown, actually. I go running. I do a lot of sport. Not nearly as much chatting as I used to. I've got quite a big family. Sport, I suppose. Yeah.
That's great.
A lot of sport.
So now that you've eliminated yourself from all of the social media, is there any way people can get a hold of you, or do you have a website? Or?
Sorry.
No forwarding addresses.
I've got my name. It's daisywood.com. I've got a website, and I've got. I'm still on Twitter, but you know, it's all. I really, it's like a bad. Addictions, and I've got at the moment it's a bit better than usual. Just don't go on it. But well, when I say that, I do. I go on it every day, but I go on it less than I do.
So you know, this isn't really a person. This is we're talking to. You can't exist if you don't have social media. No real person that doesn't happen.
I think it might again. Do you think it might? I think people. I'm optimistic. My children, well, the one's 24, one's 21, they're pretty sick of it all. I think maybe people will just think, you know what, this is not very rewarding. This isn't, you never know. Maybe people will get a little bit sick.
No, I think they will. I think it's like anything. There's a big novelty and it's a big crush, and then there's people, you know, over a period of time, you've got to start living some real life.
You know,
I think that hits as people get older. So I think you'll see changes in it, but I think it'll still be around, just differently, you know. Less people's eating. Hopefully.
Yeah, I hope so.
Yeah, no more dinner plates, you know, being flashed around. Everyone's living the good life on the computer, but
Right, exactly.
Home and having beans and nothing really
going on. Their faces fall off.
Yeah, it's just like their hair is a mess if they have hair. Yeah, they don't look like Kim Kardashian naturally, right?
No,
like, you know, come on. It's a lot of surgery there. So, well, it's been interesting. It's been a lot of fun. So now, of course, the book you need to go out and buy is called In the Crypt with the with a Candlestick. And just look for the author, Daisy Waugh, as we say in the Yankee land. And it'll be up on our website as well, so people listening can do one click and you can pick up the book. And if you see it under Castle Beardsley, it's okay. It's the right book. Don't worry about it. Just buy it. So I want to thank our guest, Daisy Waugh, for being here.
Thank you very much. That was great. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Daisy.
Tired of wasting time trying to decide what to watch on your streaming service? Go to our website and look for the Martino Movie Reviews.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.